The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Reoccurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times column, Forbidden Tablecloth.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but Christians are always filled with hate speech. Well, hold on. That's not true. Not true at all. Often Christians do nothing but share their own opinions, and because such opinions are not fashionable, because such opinions are not politically correct, they get unjustly accused of hate speech. However, what I just went over with you was the rule. Unfortunately, there are exceptions to the rule. For example, Westboro Baptist Church has definitely exhibited hate speech. Small little church from Kansas, small congregation, only 70-some people, and yet they've been raising havoc all over the country. And yes, it has been horrible hate speech, be that as it may. Their speech was protected last week by a Supreme Court ruling. Now, landmark court decisions often leave a peculiar fragrance behind, spawning a plethora of mixed feelings. Such emotional roller coasters may understandably look like a contradiction, but the truth is, feelings and laws are often owned in unavoidable tension with each other. The latest Supreme Court case regarding Westboro Baptist serves as a perfect example. For years, the Westboro protesters have reared their unpopular little heads in various places around the country, exhibiting a not-so-shy willingness to share fierce opposition to government policies that they feel promote homosexuality. A 2006 funeral for Marine Matthew Snyder was no exception. Snyder had been killed in Iraq. As it happens, Matthew Snyder was not even gay anyway. This did not stop the Westboro protesters from exploiting his death, using the opportunity to protest our military anyway. Prior to the funeral, Westboro parishioners did inform local authorities of their intention to picket the service. Because they remained 1,000 feet away without blocking entrance to the funeral, they stayed technically within the law. But oh, their signs were extremely provocative, saying things like, "Thank God for dead soldiers," "God hates fags," and "You're going to hell." Just despicable things to say anywhere, particularly at a funeral. Snyder's father decided to sue Westboro pastor Fred Phelps. Originally, a jury awarded Mr. Snyder some $11 million in damages for invasion of privacy and emotional distress deliberately inflicted. The case was appealed and ultimately taken up by the Supreme Court, which ruled in an 8-1 decision that the Westboro protests were protected under our First Amendment. As Chief Justice Roberts wrote in his majority opinion, "Speech is powerful. It can stir people to action, move them to tears of both joy and sorrow, and as it did here, inflict great pain. On the facts before us, we cannot react to that pain by punishing the speaker. As a nation, we have chosen a different course to protect even hurtful speech on public issues to ensure that we do not stifle public debate." Roberts also said, and I quote him here, "Westboro addressed matters of public import on public property in a peaceful manner in full compliance with the guidance of local officials." Now, Justice Samuel Alito wrote passionately as the lone dissenter. He said, "Our profound national commitment to free and open debate is not a license for the vicious verbal assault that occurred in this case. In order to have a society in which public issues can be openly and vigorously debated, it is not necessary to allow the brutalization of innocent victims like petitioner. I therefore respectfully dissent." Okay, so folks, how do we process all this? I'm sure we would all agree it's difficult not to sympathize with Alito in this case, but despite our justified emotions, the legalities relating to the First Amendment cannot be ignored. People's speech is often offensive. Our forefathers knew as much. If speech was always going to be friendly, welcomed, or benign, it would not need protection. Let me say that again. If speech was always going to be friendly, welcomed, and benign, it would not need protection. In an age with ongoing discussion about possible hate speech laws, fairness doctrines, or localism, a seemingly different discussion which actually resembles the fairness doctrine, we should be grateful for a Supreme Court responsibly protecting our rights to freedom of speech. Now, admittedly, it would be nice to have a law that protects free speech but lists the protest of a funeral as an exception, despite the protesters being 1,000 feet away. Unfortunately, human beings tend to do things in the extreme, and they are not very good with exceptions to the rule. For this reason, even the slightest erosion of free speech should meet with objection. Yes, we already have certain qualifications, such as laws against libel, but we are always treading upon thin ice, very thin ice, where speech is concerned, and we must be careful. For this reason, sadly, reluctantly, this radio talk show host agrees with the Supreme Court ruling. Now then, having said that, to celebrate the reinforcement of our First Amendment liberties, allow me to exercise mine by sharing with my listeners just exactly how I feel about Westboro Baptist Church. Their disgusting, hateful noise reminds us very little of the God they claim to follow and has much more in common with a foul pond scum. It is true that the Bible lists homosexuality as a sin. It is not true that God hates homosexuals. The Bible teaches that all of us are guilty of some kind of sin, and the message of Jesus was one of forgiveness and healing. To be fair, as finite human beings, we cannot read minds, and it is difficult to assess motives, including the motives of Westboro Baptist. Maybe they believe with all their hearts that they are truly obeying God. Still, one wonders why the conscience God placed inside of them is not kicking in with a little more skill. In any event, whatever their intentions, our country is left with the results. Westboro Baptists may have protested 1,000 feet away, but they are setting the reputation of Christianity back by 1,000 years. As a Christian apologist and as a full-time minister, I call upon Christian leaders everywhere to renounce this sick, twisted, miserable excuse for a church and instead point people toward our real God, a God of love and mercy. Make no mistake, Westboro exhibits behavior even a Christian apologist cannot defend. But thank God for America, a land where our First Amendment freedoms allow us to speak out against congregations such as Westboro Baptist. If we don't protect the rights of the nutcases, sooner or later somebody will be coming after our rights. Remember, there are people who don't want Christians to express any disagreement with the lifestyle of homosexuality, even in a loving way. And in Canada, it is already against the law to do just that. Here in America, there's growing belief that the name of Jesus does not belong in our public institutions unless somebody stubs his toe and uses the name of Jesus while he's swearing. Have you ever heard anybody do that with another religion? Can you imagine somebody stubbing his toe and going, "Oh, Buddha"? You don't hear that. It's only Jesus that gets this honor. Well, religion is viewed by some as a non-intellectual exercise, but even apart from that, many assume for constitutional reasons that religion should be left out of the classroom, even at our major universities. But I'm going to give you a different way of thinking about it today. Perhaps discussion of Jesus does belong on a college campus. Maybe people should be allowed to talk candidly about religious figures in the classroom or at special seminar. Here are a few things to consider. First of all, Jesus is not merely a religious figure, but an historical figure. Although the New Testament itself can certainly be defended as an accurate collection of historical documents and eyewitness accounts, it may be of interest to people that Jesus was also mentioned by other ancient historians who weren't Christians, such as the Roman writer Tacitus. and the Jewish writer Josephus, neither of whom ever converted to Christianity. Here are the words from Josephus in his Antiquities of the Jews, Book 18. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct to this day. That was the ancient historian Flavius Josephus, a contemporary with some of the apostles. This is a text outside of the New Testament by somebody who was not a Christian, who not only acknowledges that Jesus lived, but that he did miracles and rose from the dead. Now, there's much controversy that surrounds this passage, but I'm going to tell you, its textual tradition is as sturdy as anything else we accept from Josephus, and historians turn to Josephus all the time when they try to understand the ancient world. In any event, the history of Jesus does not ride upon this one narrative. We can also look to the Talmud, Pliny the Younger, the Acts of Pilate, Lucian of Samosata, Thallus. I already mentioned Tacitus. On top of that is an additional passage in Josephus about Jesus that nobody questions. For now, it suffices to say that Jesus is definitely an historical figure, and the very notion that an institution of higher learning would censor discussion about a person of history is rather bizarre. Now, here's another reason that Jesus belongs on the college campus. Jesus is talked about by professors quite a bit. Anyway, they already talk about, they talk about him in a negative way, but they do talk about him. In typical religious studies classes, many professors say on orientation day, "In this class, we will not critique religions. We will merely study what they teach and allow them to speak for themselves." What they mean is that they will not critique any religion except Christianity. And then they continue, "In this class, we are going to learn to respect all religions." What they mean is that you're going to learn to respect all religions except Christianity. On the day you study Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, Judaism, or even some religion about aliens being hatched from space pods, you will learn about how beautiful the religion is. On the day you study Christianity, you will learn that the Bible is a chauvinistic book and a racist book. It promotes genocide and even rape. The Bible is also full of contradictions. Oh yes, and the Bible has been rewritten and mistranslated. Any Christian who dares to argue with the professor tries to defend the gospel. He hears, whoa, buddy, back up. Separation between church and state. You're not allowed to preach in here. Funny how this separation never cuts both ways. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Does Jesus belong on the college campus? I'm making a case that he does. The first thing I pointed out was that Jesus was a historical figure, that this is corroborated even from documentation of the ancient world outside of the New Testament. Second point I was making before the break is that he's talked about all the time in class anyway, but in a negative way. Religious studies professors just rip into Christianity. It's only when a Christian tries to support it that they accuse him of preaching and they talk about separation between church and state. And I was marveling how that separation never seems to cut both ways. People can say any vile thing they want about Christianity, but we Christians dare not defend ourselves. See how it works? If professors feel the campus is an inappropriate place to mention Jesus, then maybe they should stop talking about him. However, the notion that the Constitution forbids religious discussion unless Christianity is being criticized smells like an open jar of pickled herring on a hot, windy day. Speaking of the Constitution, that's another reason Jesus belongs on the campus. The phrase separation between church and state is found nowhere in the Constitution anywhere. And I mean no place. The First Amendment reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free speech," or actually it says prohibiting the free exercise thereof, but of course they mean free speech. That's it. That's all. That one line is what all the bugaboo is about. How then did the myth of separation between church and state raise its ugly head? It actually began in the year 1947 in a court case called Everson versus the Board of Education. The court said, and I quote, "The First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable." They were quoting Thomas Jefferson, but quoting him out of context. Jefferson did use the phrase in a letter he wrote the Baptists, the Danbury Baptists of Connecticut, whose members were concerned at that time that the new federal constitution, and it was new at the time, the new federal constitution might begin to limit the rights of the church. The fear was that if it was the government's prerogative to grant religious freedom, it was also its prerogative to take away religious freedom. They felt that it came from nobody but God and should be granted by nobody but God. So the Danbury Baptists asked Jefferson to affirm that religious rights were inalienable rights before our supreme creator, not privileges which the state invented. Jefferson agreed with them. And in 1802, he wrote, "Believing with you that religion is a matter that lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." So Jefferson clearly uses the phrase separation between church and state to agree with the Danbury Baptists that they are free before God to practice their religion as they see fit. Now, if we're told where we're allowed to talk about God and where we aren't, isn't that interfering with our free exercise thereof? I mean, come on. When our country was founded, our fathers were determined to avoid the way of Europe. Europe had had quite a tarnished history. Different countries declared their own brand of Christianity. Italy, of course, was Catholic. England was Church of England. Germany was, for the most part, Lutheran, depending on which part you lived in. Switzerland was Reformed. At times, one risked death to break from the religion of his country. In America, it would be different. There would be no mandatory state church. People could participate in any Christian denomination they wished, or choose not to be religious at all. Now, this did not mean that we were not allowed to mention the Bible at school or pray in public. American colleges taught the Bible well into the early years of the Republic. Harvard was started as a school for prophets. Yes, started before we became a republic, but it continued that tradition many years after. Today, secular activists, while claiming they are only looking out for their own rights, ignore the fact that their right to be unreligious has not been infringed upon by our great Constitution. Indeed, many of them are systematically eroding the rights of Christians, and they are doing it with historical revision. Jesus always has and always will belong on the college campus. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious. But there's another matter which also needs to be made obvious, because discussion about toning down the rhetoric continues, yet many still wait in vain for President Obama, a self-professed champion of civil discourse, to take issue with Democratic Representative Steve Cohen, who on the floor of the House of Representatives compared Republican disagreement with our new health care law to the Nazis. Sweet. Perhaps those inflammatory words flew quickly off his lips because that tired old Nazi analogy has become fashionable, In fact, it was not so long ago that Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles and Governor Jesse Ventura of Minnesota offered similar observations with other Republican deeds. Mahoney condemned the new Arizona immigration law, likening it to the Holocaust. Reality check. The problem in World War II was not German police interrogating non-citizens. The Cardinal's irresponsible statement displays ignorance at the very least and exploitive cruelty at the very most. If Mahoney is aware of what went on in the real Holocaust, he should be ashamed of himself for making such a statement. It isn't as simple as saying, well, the Nazis asked people to show their papers, and now the Arizona police asked people to share their pictures. Any American who has traveled out of our country has had to show papers. Some good examples would be a passport or a driver's license. Remember those? How did such documentation become so controversial? When the Nazi Gestapo looked at papers, it was often with the purpose of hauling people off to concentration camps. Nothing of the kind is going on in Arizona. And to actually have to stop and say so is such an understatement. It feels strange to even have this conversation. Neither should the word Nazi be defined as a person who debates one healthcare system as opposed to another, or a man who displays too much enthusiasm, as Jesse Ventura pointed out on cable news during the last presidential election. Remember? Ventura noted that the Republican convention reminded him of a Nazi rally. Naturally, a statement laced with such thought and wit was backed up with actual facts. It seems that when the war on terror was mentioned, Republicans shouted with enthusiasm. Evidently, this reminded Ventura of Joseph Goebbels' ability to bring people into war. Yikes. Say it isn't so, Jesse. We're all tracking with you now. The comparison is so obvious. It's a wonder nobody else noticed it before. The Nazis encouraged a war. Republicans are encouraging a war. The Nazis had rallies. Republicans have rallies. The Nazis were enthusiastic. Republicans are enthusiastic. Evidently, all wars are the same, regardless of whether a country is attacking or fighting because she herself was attacked. And a loud rally is a loud rally, period. Yes, these are the times we live in. If you want to take a political cheap shot, just compare the opposition to the Nazis. This show has had more performances than Phantom of the Opera. Now, in all fairness to Cohen, Mahoney, and Ventura, many others have been known to use the word Nazi, or at least the word fascist, to describe Republicans, conservatives, evangelical Christians, and the man who probably holds the all-time record of Hitler comparisons, George W. Bush. We'll talk about that when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric. Welcome back to our program. We're talking about ridiculously stupid comparisons to the Nazis. Well, probably in the last few years, nobody's been compared to the Nazis more than George W. Bush. It is high time to state what should be common knowledge, but unfortunately is not. If you think Bush is even remotely similar to Hitler, it means you know nothing about Hitler or nothing about Bush, or most likely nothing about either man. The same holds true when you make similar appraisals with Sarah Palin or the Tea Party movement. And yes, in the interest of balance, just to show you I'm a fair guy, conservatives should also be discouraged from comparing Obama to Hitler. Our country relates far too many events to the Holocaust today, and by doing so, we water down the real, honest-to-goodness, vicious evil of the Nazis until people turn numb to the very word Holocaust. PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, even put up a website with a picture of, you're going to love this, a picture of fried chicken next to a picture of Auschwitz concentration camp with a caption saying, "The New Holocaust." See? Visiting Colonel Sanders and getting a bucket of extra crispy and killing people in gas chambers are one and the same. And if you don't agree, you are as bad as Hitler. Is today's generation aware of what actually happened in the genuine Holocaust of German history? Did you know that Jews were slaughtered not because they were accidentally bombed, but because they were rounded up for the specific purpose of having their entire race exterminated? Did you know the death tally with Jews reached 6 million, not to mention all the other millions Hitler killed? Did you hear about the gassings, which included women and children? How about babies thrown alive into ovens? And people are comparing this to Presidents Obama and President Bush, or to policemen who ask for a driver's license, or Republicans showing enthusiasm over fighting terrorists? This would be funny if it weren't such dangerous, destructive ignorance. Now, having acknowledged the foolish misuse of Nazi concern, there are legitimate comparisons to Hitler and Nazism in America today. I mean, if you really need to make such an analogy, some pertinent facts are in order. No, we cannot find any parallel to the latter deeds or the final solution. And it is disgraceful when Republicans or Democrats use a word like Nazi as a quick, lazy method of disgracing people merely because they hold an alternative ideology. However, to place that comment in careful, delicate, specific qualification, the unfair comparison is limited to the actions of the SS and their venomous death camps. This does not mean we should ignore the early years of Nazi movements and its embryonic form. When examining how fascists came into power gradually, some chilling familiarity is unavoidable. Euthanasia serves as one immediate example. Mentally challenged people in Germany were quietly, systematically put to death so that Germans could foster quality lives who contributed something useful to society. The people that were killed first were not the Jews. They were the mentally challenged. Such actions were preceded with talk about selective breeding. Now, no, this has not exactly happened in America yet, but we have come dangerously close. Margaret Sanger, the much-admired founder of Planned Parenthood, also believed in genetic breeding. She even had Hitler's eugenicist write an article for her birth control review. Of course, before Hitler could get away with these deeds, he had to suppress free speech. He accomplished this by making himself popular, and he made himself popular by promising to redistribute wealth amongst the rich and poor. Does any of this sound at least a little bit familiar? To give both Democrats and Republicans a bit of a break, people are often unaware of what the extreme factions in their own party advocate. So it would be inappropriate to paint everybody with a sweeping brush here. But please think for a moment. Of the two major parties, which one advocates partial birth abortion? Which one wanted to see Terri Schiavo put to death? Which one encourages the suppression of free speech by shouting down guest speakers on college campuses or seeking laws such as the Fairness Doctrine? And who vilifies the rich with promises of mandatory wealth redistribution? Who behaves like a modern-day Neville Chamberlain seeking to have peace talks with Ahmadinejad, the snake-like dictator who brags openly about his desire to annihilate the Jewish race? If we really want to locate a smaller, budding version of fascist-type thought or people who placate to Nazi-style values, do we find it amongst those on the right or those on the left? And once again, most Americans, be they liberal or be they conservative, are in agreement, for now at least, that the final, ultimate accomplishments of the latter Nazis must be opposed, and it is unfair for either side to compare political opponents to horrific, war crime atrocities. At the same time, we'd be well served to also study the early winds of fascist-laced ideology. History, after all, has an uncanny way of repeating itself, and seemingly harmless beliefs tend to get out of control like wildfire. Such a warning may not pass the politically correct litmus test of toning down the rhetoric, but perhaps it is best to pay less attention to the tone of a remark and more attention to whether or not the remark happens to be true. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, our call-in toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. People also send in their comments through Twitter, through Facebook, or just by contacting me directly over the email on the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. Many are leaving comments right after my columns. For the last few months, I've been writing a column for the Washington Times online. And in the column, you find literary versions of the monologues I give on the radio show. For example, I wrote a column about Hitler and the Nazis and people comparing Americans of either party to Hitler and the Nazis. Same stuff I just went over. And John, reacting to that, says Hitler and the Nazis were always on the far right. This is proven by the stab in the back legend. Conservatives, nationalists, and ex-military leaders began to speak critically about the peace in Weimar. Politicians, socialists, communists, Jews, and sometimes even Catholics were viewed with suspicion due to presumed extra-national loyalties. It was claimed that they had not supported the war and had played a role in selling out Germany to its enemies. These November criminals, or those who seemed to benefit from the newly formed Weimar Republic, were seen to have stabbed them in the back on the home front by either criticizing German nationalism, instigating unrest and strikes in the critical military industries, or profiteering. In essence, the accusation was that the accused committed treason against the benevolent and righteous common cause. Okay, John, the only reasons Nazis are thought of as far right or right wing is because of the strong nationalistic language of Hitler. He believed in a redistribution of wealth as much as any communist. The only difference is that communists think globally rather than nationally. And John, I mentioned this talk about wealth redistribution from Hitler, along with other things like euthanasia, which today resemble the positions of the left, not the right. You conspicuously failed to respond to that part of my message. Well, we've got more to read, and we will be right back to read them. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Back to our program. I'm reading some comments to the literary version of the monologue I just shared with you about comparisons to the Nazis. My point was that it's unfair to be comparing Republicans or Democrats to the latter deeds of the Nazis. But I did point out that if we looked at the euthanasia and the wealth redistribution of the early Nazis, we could look at some comparisons. The Republican Party of San Diego calls this a great article. That's the good news. Somebody disagrees, and the somebody who disagrees is Cardinal Mahoney's spokesperson. When you go on the radio and write for the Washington Times, sometimes the people you're talking about are listening. This is from Todd Tamberg. He says, I am the spokesman for the Los Angeles Archdiocese. I'm always especially wary of journalists who violate commandment number one of their craft. Thou shalt not misspell proper names. Not only does Mr. Siegel refer to Cardinal Mahony repeatedly, the correct spelling is M-A-H-O-N-Y rather than M-A-H-O-N-E-Y. He apparently violates another commandment of journalism, thou shalt check thy sources. He claims that Cardinal Mahony likened Arizona's law to the Holocaust. Not so. In fact, Cardinal Mahony never even mentions the word Holocaust in the blog post on his website. By the way, the word Holocaust should always be capitalized, Mr. Siegel. Here is what the Cardinal wrote. The law is wrongly assuming that Arizona residents, including local law enforcement personnel, will now shift their total attention to guessing which Latino-looking or foreign-looking person may or may not have proper documents. That's also nonsense. American people are fair-minded and respectful. I can't imagine Arizonians now reverting to German Nazi and Russian communist techniques whereby people are required to turn one another in to the authorities on any suspicion of documentation. Are children supposed to call 911 because one parent does not have proper papers? Are family members and neighbors now supposed to spy on one another, create total distrust across neighborhoods and communities, and report people because of suspicious-based ignorance? Yes, Mr. Siegel, and then he quotes from my article, perhaps it is best to pay less attention to the tone of a remark and more attention to whether or not the remark happens to be true. In this case, the remark you attribute to Cardinal Mahony is not true. So will you obey another commandment of journalism? Thou shalt retract that which is false. Sincerely, Todd Tamberg. Okay, now I want to read to you exactly what I wrote back to Mr. Tamberg because we had a little interesting exchange after this. To Todd Tamberg, thank you for your letter. I appreciate your attempts to clarify Cardinal Mahony's comments. First of all, I do apologize for the misspelling of his name. God knows my own name gets misspelled much of the time, and yes, it can be quite annoying. The correction has been made. I do think this is pretty low-level stuff in as much as Mahony with an EY is a common spelling of the name, and my computer's spell check keeps listing Mahony with just the Y as an incorrect spelling, but such is the nature of proper names and spell checks, so please accept my apology nevertheless. Regarding the capitalization of Holocaust, I have seen the event described both ways, with and without capitalization. I myself have sometimes capitalized a word, but my computer spell check never insists on it. Since you seemed to bring this up as a means of respecting Holocaust victims, let me add, as one who is himself Jewish and quite sensitive to the subject, it matters not to me how people spell the word, so long as they understand the event. As for the cardinal not using the word Holocaust, this is irrelevant. He described Germans turning their neighbors into the Nazi German police. When such neighbors were Jewish, they were taken to concentration camps, and this was certainly a key feature of the Holocaust. So Mahony certainly did liken the Arizona law to the Holocaust, whether he actually used the word or not. If he was that eager to avoid a Holocaust association, he would have been well advised to not use the word Nazi. Warmest regards, Bob Siegel. Well, that ended the matter, right? No, of course that didn't end the matter. From Todd again. No, Bob, Cardinal Mahony did not liken the Arizona law to the Holocaust. The comment of guest at 4:16 p.m. highlights the intention of the Cardinal's reference to the tactics of repressive regimes like that in Germany and the Soviets. He didn't liken it to the Holocaust. He just likened it to the repressive Nazi regime of Germany. Oh, that clears it up. Okay, and he says, and effectively guts the premise of your column in response to me. Work on that spell check, my friend. It matters. See how gracious he accepted my apology. By the way, I always do a Google search when I do a proper name. Sometimes the spell check corrects it. Sometimes you don't always notice what the spell check does. I wish that hadn't happened, but boy, talk about making a mountain out of a molehill. So this was my response to him once again. Well, I'll tell you what, Mr. Tamberg, Cardinal Mahony is welcome to come on my radio show to defend his comments and answer my direct questions about his comments. Journalism couldn't have a more direct or clarifying experience, could it? What do you say? How does Todd respond to this? Right, to defend comments he did not make to a guy who can't even spell his name correctly? We'll pass. Thanks anyway. Okay, now, of course, other readers were watching this little exchange. And responding to this, Nina says, well, Bob, it seems that Todd Tamberg and Cardinal Mahoney are taking the easy way out of the disagreement. Instead of addressing the disagreement in a clear manner, he makes a big issue of one letter in a name. Let's see, isn't that called a red herring argument? A sad substitute for honest and clear debate. Well, that's how I see it. Nina also writes, I especially appreciate your historical acknowledgement of Planned Parenthood and Hitler's eugenics program. And then she quotes again from my article. Margaret Singer, the much-admired founder of Planned Parenthood, also believed in genetic breeding. She even had Hitler's eugenicists write an article for her birth control review. Maureen on Facebook says, isn't this typical liberal behavior? Comes right out of the liberal handbook, the liberal Ten Commandments of how to argue. Steve says, great write-up. Pam says, Tamberg's response to your invitation for Mahoney to come on your radio show sounds like a four-year-old. You spelled his name wrong and we're not coming to your party, so there. Great article, Bob. This is the same Cardinal Mahoney who admitted sheltering Father Michael Baker, now serving prison time for abusing up to 500 victims. Nice. And a fellow who goes by the nickname Slow Newsday says, what a hypocrite Mahoney is after covering up the priest sex abuse cases in his own arena, bringing discredit to a church he is not worthy to serve. Well, we're continuing to read comments to the things we've been talking about today. Responding to my thoughts on Westboro Baptist, Nils writes, good, Bob. As much as we might not like the results of this particular decision, remember, what if the signs were ambiguous? Would we rather a judge or jury decide what was offensive or hateful, quote unquote? Or should we let people's common sense decide how to view such protests? I prefer the latter. Patty on Facebook says, excellent as always, Bob. What would we do without your amazing and insightful take on these difficult things? Well, that's very gracious of you, Patty. Thank you. However, my next comment is not nearly as nice. It comes from a fellow who calls himself RJB, and he is responding to my comments about Jesus on the college campus, the Washington Times version. He says, this is rambling and inarticulate, as anti-intellectual a piece of prose as I have ever come across. I don't know who this Bob Siegel is, but I suspect he has never darkened the doors of a university campus. Of course, college professors talk about Christ, comparative religion, divinity, theology, art, history, literature, classics. It is impossible to study any field of the humanities without developing a sympathetic understanding of the history of Christianity. The question is, how should we talk about religion in academia? And the answer is, not surprisingly, we should talk about religion academically. This means being cautious, critical, impartial insofar as possible, and willing to admit a large degree of uncertainty. This is quite different from how religions talk about themselves, and rightly so. A college campus is not a church, and a podium is not a pulpit. I will tell you how I respond to our friend RJ when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. To build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. Welcome back to our program. A fellow named RJB just took me to task for my comments about Jesus and the college campus. Here's my response. First of all, RJ, you called it anti-intellectual, but you failed to refute one single solitary intellectual point I made. So who's being rambling and inarticulate here? As for your suspicion that I never darkened the doors of a university campus, normally I wouldn't grace such a comment with a response, but today I think I'm going to have a little fun with this. I'm just in a fun mood. So if the audience will indulge me, let me start by pointing out that my biography is listed right next to my column on the Washington Times. All RJ had to do was read it to see that I graduated both from San Jose State University and Denver Seminary. Now, I'm sure he would immediately dismiss Denver Seminary, even though it is accredited both in Christian and secular circles, but that's okay. We want to be fair, so fine. We'll just take Denver off the table and instead point out that I have been a guest lecturer on college campuses from the mid-80s all the way up to the 2000s. I have spoken in classrooms. I have spoken at special seminars. I have spoken at outdoor open forums in the campus free speech area. I have debated professors. I have listened to literally hundreds of students talk about their experience with religious studies classes. I've been on the East Coast, the West Coast, the Midwest, and the Southwest. I have spoken at UC Irvine, UC Santa Barbara, Penn State, Fresno State, Oregon State, Arizona State, Willamette University, Cal State Stanislaus, SUNY College in Albany, New York, Worcester College in Massachusetts, University of Utah, University of Minnesota, University of Washington. Okay, that's enough. My sponsors pay for this radio time, so I won't take up the rest of the show talking about the college campuses I've spoken on. But I will respond to some other comments made by our pal and yours, RJ. He said, the question is, how should we talk about religion in academia? And the answer is, not surprisingly, we should talk about religion academically. This means being cautious, critical, impartial, insofar as possible, and willing to admit a large degree of uncertainty. This is quite different from how religions talk about themselves, and rightly so. A college campus is not a church, and a podium is not a pulpit. Well, my whole point, RJ, which you seemed to ignore, was that there is an academic way of defending Christianity. To say that the only way to talk about Christianity academically is to criticize it, and to say that religious people have no intellectual arguments to offer is simply untrue. As a matter of fact, I offered some arguments from history, which once again you omitted from your comments. Now, next, I'm taken to task by a guy named Stu. His letter is so long, I'm going to break it up and respond a piece at a time. He says, there is so, copy the letters here, there is so much wrong here, it's hard to know where to begin. Well, Stu, that should have served as a cue to not begin, because after you begin, your argument goes steadily downhill. Stu says, the first relates to biblical scholarship. There is much doubt among historians as to the existence of an actual historical Jesus, which this author asserts as fact. No doubt from the body of reputed historians, Christian and non-Christian alike, who have been involved with serious biblical scholarship these past 100 years, Stu, what you're doing is getting your talking points from anti-Christian websites. The reason I know that is I recognize them. I know them very well. Stu continues, the tales attributed to Jesus are also attributed to other figures, and the name Jesus is hardly unique for the period. Jesus, therefore, belongs in classrooms in the same way that Zeus, Apollo, and the Mayan gods are, as comparative religions or mythos. Stu, that Jesus was a common name is a non-argument. If it was a common name, that only points to the odds that we're talking about a real person. As for comparisons with other religions, the Bible outdates Greek mythology, at least the Old Testament. And the Old Testament predicts a lot of the things of the New Testament, such as the resurrection, such as the virgin birth of Jesus. And the comparisons, I've seen them, oh, they're a stretch of the imagination. For instance, he mentions Zeus. Now, some have compared the virgin birth of Jesus to the birth of Athena, daughter of Zeus, because Athena popped out of Zeus's head. So they're comparing the virgin birth of Jesus to Athena popping out of Zeus's head. Yeah, I get these counts mixed up all the time. Stu continues, secondly, this author has a truly faulty knowledge of the First Amendment and a concept called synonymous. For instance, the action of not establishing original or impeding the practice thereof is the precise action of a wall of separation and therefore synonymous or analogous to such a wall. But don't take my word for it. It was James Madison, with a bit of guidance from Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the amendment. Here is a direct quote. The purpose of separation of church and state is to keep forever from these shores, the endless strife that has soaked the soil of Europe in blood for centuries. That was from President James Madison. He says, this certainly is not out of context. I would also argue that this author twists the context of Jefferson's quote as he ignores why Jefferson wrote it. I'll leave that to you to explore. Suffice to say, the walls are not one way. Jefferson meant it both ways. Excuse me, Stu, how does allowing discussion of Jesus in the private sector counter anything that Madison said or anything that Jefferson said? It doesn't. Then he goes on to say, their meaning is clear. The United States, made up of many different people of many different faiths and cultures, is to be a secular government. That does not mean that government employees and officials cannot practice their religion, but that they do so on their own personal time. If the demands of their faith won't allow this, then they should seek another line of work. Of course, this should be no problem for Christians, for the words of Jesus are recorded in the Bible, admonishes his followers to not make a big public display as the Pharisees do, but to pray to the Lord in secret. Make no mistake, jobs in the public school are government jobs, period. Stu, Jesus was talking about religious hypocrites. You acknowledged that yourself when you used the word Pharisees. Pharisees who were bragging about their spirituality. He was saying, if as an alternative to bragging, pray in private. He was not telling Christians that they cannot practice their religion publicly if they're not bragging. Why did Jesus himself get crucified? Because he practiced his religion publicly. And you're ignoring Jesus' command to take the gospel to the entire world, Matthew 28. You can't quote part of the Bible and ignore the rest of it. This isn't a place for cherry picking. You're ignoring the book of Acts, where the gospel was preached on the streets and thousands became saved. Then he says, this author then piles on Josephus. Didn't the Council of Nicaea exclude his writings as heresies? No, Stu, they didn't. Council was concerned about the heresies of Christians. Josephus was a non-Christian. My whole point in citing him as a corroborative source for the New Testament. Stu continues. Don't you just love Stu? Christian apologists seem to want it both ways. Ignore these writings unless something in them is useful as well, Stu. As you can see, I did not ignore it. I just explained it to you. Stu says, this is shuck and jive of the most obvious. As I said, Jesus and any other Christian character is certainly a component of a comparative religions class or a class on superstition and myth, but not, he says, not in big capital letters, not in, say, a science classroom or a history class. And you know that Jesus does not belong in a historical discussion. How exactly, Stu? You have said nothing to prove such a point, just as you offered nothing to refute intelligent design taught by many scientists. Stu says the accounts we have today are unverified and unverifiable. They amount to folktales, and indeed were passed along orally until many years, about three decades, after the event supposedly happened. Prove it, Stu. Prove that they amount to folktales. They were not passed orally. They were passed in a written fashion. The New Testament was completed at the end of the first century. You said yourself that the earliest copies we have are 3 centuries old. That's because they're comparing things from the 3rd and 4th century that went on in the 1st century. He says, to make things even shakier, no original scripture exists. The surviving manuscripts are no older than the 3rd century. Stu, you just threw out all ancient history. All ancient history comes in the form of copies. The printing press had not yet been invented. They had to copy it. They couldn't save it on their hard drive. They had to copy it. You mentioned yourself that there's only a gap of several hundred years. That is true of the best manuscripts, but actually some papyrus fragments come within 30 years. Compare this to people that we accept all the time, from the time that Aristotle, the philosopher, lived and wrote, to the earliest copy of an Aristotle manuscript, we have a time gap of 1,400 years. Sophocles, the Greek playwright, I was a drama major in college. That included a lot of drama lit classes. Never, ever did one of my professors get up and say Sophocles didn't exist. Sophocles didn't write plays. Well, from the time of Sophocles to the earliest copy of a Sophocles manuscript, 1,500 years. Stu continues, they've been subject to errors in transcription, both intentional and unintentional, for hundreds of years before anything like a printing press came along. Well, I'm glad you're acknowledging that they didn't have a printing press and they needed to copy it, Stu. But Stu, my friend, the only reason we know of the errors of some manuscripts is because other manuscripts did not make those errors. And we compared them. See how it works? Stu says, as you may be able to see right now, it's fascinating to study scripture. Just leave ridiculous indoctrination to the churches. Well, once again, Stu, I was not talking about indoctrination. I was talking about an intellectual defense. Had you been more familiar with it, you would not have made the comments that you did. Well, I got one more here. This guy calls himself Left Jab. He says, reading your delusional creed is why the term Jesus freak was coined. Wow, Left Jab, you sure showed me. Your comment was so intellectual and so kind. You know, never in my life have I referred to atheists or skeptics as freaks. What a wonderful world it would be if everybody stopped being a Christian and became just like you. But I'll continue to defend Christianity this time next week. We'll see you then.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.